welcome to the podcast. Thanks for talking to me. I really appreciate that.
Thank you for having me.
So yeah, what is your current role and where are you based?
So I'm a professor in, let's say, food science and technology in a broad sense at Brussels University in Belgium.
And what does that role imply? Research and teaching or? Yeah.
Yes. Teaching, research, administration, quite a bit.
I can imagine. So you teach mostly around nutrition?
Yes, I have a nutrition course. I also have a course on food chemistry, one on food technology, and one on food microbiology. And then there's a new course coming up on sustainable agri-food systems next year.
Which is going to be interesting with your perspective, of course. So mm-hmm. I first became aware of your work through posts on Twitter, now X, about the campaign against meat and your comments against claims in the media, you know, that meat is bad for you, and your comments on the World Health Organization's kind of view on this and the Eat Lancet diet. And I mean, I can assume you were talking about this on other platforms also, but this is where I saw it the first time. So maybe the first question is there a campaign against meat?
Well, I think there is, yes. It's maybe not one monolithic campaign as such, but there's certainly an anti-meat sentiment, and that anti-meat sentiment is to be found in diverse and different types of environments. You have, of course, the activists that are campaigning against meat since they've always have done for decades, but also you find it in parts of the industry, you'll find it at policy level, you'll find it in various NGOs with either environmental or maybe animal rights agendas. So there are various voices, they're not necessarily aligned, so they may have even conflicting views, but there's an anti-meat sentiment that is spread throughout society and amplified quite a bit. Now, mind you, I think it's probably a minority voice, but it's amplified quite a bit. So it gives you the impression that there's a massive anti-meat campaign, even though it's only there are only few players that are actually coming with radical points of view, but they get a lot of exposure.
So that amplification is it just social media that brought it along, or do you feel that these different groups started holding hands in a way and that amplified it?
Oh, certainly it's both. Social media plays its part, of course. And especially the way that the algorithms are now steering us towards polarized discussions and all of that. But conventional mass media also plays its role. And that has to do with a number of things, especially the way that how journalism has evolved over the years and how the business model of those outlets has also changed. But then you have also those big platforms where and particularly also those public-private partnerships where you have mixtures of NGOs and business and policymakers and academia all together, where they coordinate part of those messages in very efficient ways, because there's often a big budget behind it as well to allow them for PR campaigns and to set up all sorts of conferences worldwide and to lobby at the highest levels. So those things contribute to the fact that the exposure is considerable, even though it's only a few players.
So what are the kind of the, let's say, three messages that you see out there the most?
Well, there are three domains in general. So the three domains are animal rights and animal welfare. That's one. And then the other domain is health and, you know, stories around cancer and cardiovascular disease and so forth. And then and the third one is the environmental bit. Now, within those three domains, you have stronger and weaker narratives. Clearly, the one in the environmental part is about greenhouse gas emissions, very much so. But sometimes you feel that the attention shifts to other things like biodiversity. There are other ones like water use, which is a bit less prominent. So, but it, depending on the moment and on the actor, you see that there's a different weight or interest in one of those topics. But generally, I would say greenhouse gas emissions are leading that conversation.
Yeah,
and then you have, land use is another one. So there are many things that are blended together to begin with. And then in the health department, probably the cancer bit is the one that comes out most. Although there's a lot of talk about still the the long-lasting view on saturated fat and cardiovascular disease that also plays its role still, but cancer probably takes most of the attention. And then in the ethical domain, it's the usual animal rights discourse on how factory farming is destroying not only the planet, but also is kind of hell for all the animals, where you have the Netflix kind of approaches where they show the worst situations and make it look like it's representative for all of livestock agriculture.
So if you would summarize the let's say the health argument, what's their health argument, and then kind of what's the counter to that? Yeah,
it's kind of probably the easiest one to formulate is just simply, you know, eat meat and you'll get cancer. It's put as simple as that. It's a very linear approach to one demonized food and one horrible health outcome, and they just draw a line in between as if that would be just a causal line that explains everything. So that's probably the easiest one. It's also the one that you hear a lot, because I think they do realize that people are mostly concerned about their health. Yeah. So they feel that this is the one that gains most traction. The other things are more abstract, but health is always a first priority. So that's why I think there's a lot of emphasis on the cancer story, even though the evidence behind it is very uncertain and very unstable.
Does your research look into that specifically?
We have looked at a couple of those things, yes, especially at how much evidence is there behind some of those statements. What are the premises? How robust are certain statements? And especially what is going on with the numbers? Because sometimes it's some very creative accountancy taking place using such numbers. And narrowing down on very simplistic assumptions rather than having the broader discussion on what it means to have a healthy dietary pattern and how that links to cardiometabolic disease, rather than taking one single food and just trying to use that to explain a very complicated interaction.
Why do you think the narrative of the Western diet, and I'm talking about the kind of the processed Western diet, why is that not in the spotlight, but this is in the spotlight? Is it just, yeah?
Well, to be fair, nowadays you see a bit of, the ultra-processed food kind of story is now receiving quite a bit of attention, to be fair. I mean, lately, the last two years maybe, because of certain books that have been published, so certain voices that become more vocal and loud. So there's a bit of attention there, but of course it's not an element that powerful agendas like to see in the spotlight, because especially the food industry now is largely based on ultra processing. The big multinationals are making ultra processed foods mostly, and it's their most interesting business model.
Yeah,
because in the end, what are ultra processed foods? They are kind of standardized materials, starches, oils, protein isolates. Then they kind of fix their way or try to construct something that looks like a food, which requires a lot of expertise and the core expertise of those companies to begin with. And then they create margins. They create value because of the processing. But essentially, the food is of very low quality. It's nutrient poor. It's hyperpalatable. It leads to overeating. So it's an extremely bad setup to, you know, if you want to improve public health. But nonetheless, very powerful companies are kind of steering that conversation. So there's a lot of opposition. Well, there has been a lot of opposition against anything that is criticizing the ultra-processed foods culture, and that's because, of course, if we're talking about those global multinational companies, they do have leverage over the public discourse.
Yeah,
that's how simple it is.
I think a lot of people read ultra processed people, and that debate started coming into kind of the media. But then what I've seen lately on LinkedIn is that those companies that make processed food are very aggressively trying to say, well, we're part of the food chain, we're part of food security. Is that just a natural knee-jerk reaction?
They're trying to just limit the damage now, and they come up with those bogus arguments like yogurt is also processed, which it is, of course, but that's absolutely not what the ultra-processed framework is telling us. So there's a very clear difference between processing, which is a good thing. I mean, we have been processing food since the earliest times. And a lot of them are very valuable because processing in a way, it helps to improve digestibility of foods. It increases nutrient bioavailability, creates shelf life. It's very, very useful. So to throw away processing would be extremely silly. And yogurt is a very valuable food.
But
it should not be confused with what they call Nova 4, which is the group of ultra-processed foods, which are essentially no longer recognizable as foods as wholesome foods as we know them. So it's all reconstituted. It's heavily branded. It's packaged. It's made by those multinationals, and we know that it's very much associated with all sorts of problems. We also know that it leads to overeating on the long term. So there are lots of things to be said. And there's a big solid case against ultra-processed foods, but those companies are trying to conflate it and to confuse the conversation by creating mist around what processing means. So you can clearly see that it's a kind of desperate reaction, where they try to limit the damage.
Why would someone like FAO or the World Health Organization climb onto this bandwagon? Because I mean, just their names kind of make you think they should be trusted. You know, they have scientists, they have resources. Why do you think they climb onto this anti-meat conversation?
Well, yeah, first of all, I think you have to be careful in looking at those organizations as one entity. They consist of different departments with different individuals, different ideas and viewpoints. Of course, you get consensus statements that come out of those organizations at some point, but generally speaking, they're much more heterogeneous than people often assume, and that's an important thing. You see a lot of clashes actually between for instance what comes out of FAO and what comes out of UNEP, United yeah. Nations Environment Program, around, you know, what agriculture means for emissions, and so even those platforms can just clash with each other. Another thing is, of course, that there have been attempts to capture those organizations. We know that there's a strategic alliance that has been set up. When was it? In 2000? Forgot the exact date now. Was it 2018? Anyway, it doesn't matter. So there's a strategic alliance between the World Economic Forum and the United Nations, where they have officially stated that they will work together to achieve sustainable development goals. Mm. So if you have the main corporations out there that are now working together on the agendas that are supposed to mitigate the damage that they've been creating, you know, you're asking for trouble. So it has to do with the funding of those organizations, their partners, the fact that they also play their part in the virtue signaling side of things. So they're trying to come across as very noble organizations, and then they capture all the buzzwords. But on the other hand, there's also good work being done by both WHO and FAO. So it's a more nuanced than people sometimes assume. The problem is with the high level statements that come out of the marketing divisions and the PR divisions of those organizations.
At what stage did you feel you had to start using like Twitter or these platforms to counter those narratives in a way? Mm.
I started to use it originally as a way, in an academic manner. Because it was very efficient at the time. Now things have changed a lot because of the way this social media evolved. But in the beginning, it was very efficient to find new literature, to find interesting papers. Once you start following people that have the same interest, you know, they bring out the new literature, and it was even more efficient than looking myself sometimes in, you know, the search engines. So it was just a very easy and efficient way to find information. But since I joined Twitter 2018, and since, a lot of things have changed. And as the years were progressing, I saw also this massive wave of anti-livestock campaigns, and I just find that fascinating. I mean, one thing is that I have the academic duty to counter the misinformation. I think that's something I should do because I'm paid by tax money, and my duty is to set the record straight, at least related to what is connected to my expertise. So I'm just supposed to do that. I mean, there's a part of my contract also states that I have to do societal outreach, and you know, I have a societal function. So I just think that I have to step in when this kind of misinformation is happening. That's one thing. But I also find it worrying as a citizen. So that's another something that contributes here. I find it worrying for myself and for my children and for future generations that we're trying to almost dismantle the foundations of our welfare societies, even beyond agriculture. And then there's a third part where I just find it fascinating from an anthropological point of view and a societal point of view and a sociological point of view to see how ideas are being shaped in a very rapid manner and changed and transformed in a very rapid manner over a few years. If we would bring the conversations we're having today on animal agriculture or eating of meat or dairy or whatever, if you would have those conversations, let's say 15 years ago, people would just say you're crazy. You know, this doesn't make any sense. That's not what the evidence says. So very strange things are happening, and I find that kind of fascinating.
Of course, a lot of people who want to counter some of these arguments in the way that you do are demonized, you know, anti-climate, you know. Does the university give you leeway to talk about it? How does that work? You know, there's a cancel culture overseas. How do they see your kind of reaction?
Well, I think there's something like academic freedom to begin with. I mean, academics are supposed to have freedom of speech, as long, of course, as they are deontologically and if they're sticking to the evidence and using the scientific method to underpin what they're saying. So whatever I'm saying is backed up by scientific points of view. I mean, some of those views may be debatable or maybe I may take scientific positions that are not universal, but I'm not taking them out of the blue or without respect for the scientific evidence. I try to build my cases based on what I think is the best evidence and what I think is stated according to the highest possible standards of evidence. So in that case, I think academics should always, I mean, the science progresses through conversation and dissonance. If everybody starts to create consensus and nobody questions anything, then we also have a huge problem. So I encourage people to, you know, to come up with new perspectives, as long, of course, as they are genuine and well-intentioned. I mean, if they're constructed lies and fabrications, then that doesn't belong in scientific debates. But we should have those, you know, more difficult conversations on what it means to have a healthy diet, what it means to have a sustainable agricultural production system, what it means to have animal welfare. There's not a single ready-made answer to all of those questions. This is ongoing scientific controversy.
I'm jumping around a bit with this question, but you were recently in Ghana, right?
Yes.
And was that a work related trip?
Yes.
What did you go and talk about there, or what did you go and do there?
The point of the mission was just to explore options for further research where we can try to maximize the potential of some of the indigenous knowledge and skills that are present in countries like Ghana. So there's a huge potential there with respect to the crops that are available, with respect to the processing methods that they have in-house based on generations and generations of traditions, and try to valorize this. And why? Just because it opens up opportunities. And it's also an option, if you're able to build on that, it's an option also, or it gives you the potential to deal with some of the challenges and dangers we're seeing also in countries like in West Africa, where you have also ultra processed food culture coming up, where you have also similar problems as the ones that we are seeing with cardiometabolic disease. So as in Europe, Africa has its own treasure chest of solutions available. We just have to look for those and understand them and try to reanimate them. So it's mostly in view of a better understanding of the resources that are available in such countries. And we don't have any clue. So that's why we would like to work together with people that understand them well and that have the expertise to inform us on that and then offer our expertise to see what we can make of all of that.
Do you think, because they already have a problem of the Western diet coming in and causing obesity and all these things that you're seeing, is that part of the reason why you were there? Would you want to counter that already, or do you want to bring that knowledge back and counter it in Europe, for instance?
Yeah, I think it's a case study. I mean, it's the West African or the Guinean case study for something that is much broader and which is much more, you know, which is really aligned with what I'm trying to do. That it's to revalue and to reappreciate what we're losing as a kind of defense against the very aggressive erosion of both public health and food culture.
So
there's a lot of potential in Ghana, there's a lot of potential in Europe, and we're trying to understand what that potential could look like, both at the technological and nutritional level, so talking about nutrients and how processing may affect certain anti-nutrients or toxins or create nutritional value to the production of vitamins or whatever. So that's a very technical, nutritional kind of outlook, but it's also the anthropological side of things where we try to better understand what those foods mean for commensality and for social interaction and bringing people together. That is the economic side of things, which relates to creating livelihoods. Identities, because a lot of the interest in the Guinean case study is also that it connects to the diaspora of Africans that have moved out of Africa and try to, you know, find a way to consolidate their identity elsewhere, and how that can help in creating that and contribute to diversity and variety.
It's interesting that you went there for that trip, because for one of my podcasts, I interviewed Dr. Emmanuel Bobobi. Now, I'm embarrassed to say I forget if he was from Ghana or Uganda, but I met him in South Africa at one of the agricultural research councils. And he was talking about cassava, and which in South America is called mandioca, and just how they were struggling to get that back into the national diet, because rice was imported and grains were imported, and that they also had all these problems and just the struggle to kind of bring it in, you know, kind of trying to make it cool again by bringing it into restaurants and losing that part of the culture. And I also found interesting some of the work that you talked about, where you looked at, I think it was Inuit cultures, where, maybe tell me about like the Inuit culture case study, where what their traditional diet was and kind of what it's been replaced with, and kind of just the discrepancies you saw in that.
Well, probably you're referring to something I talked about one of, I don't know, presentations or podcasts before, and that's when I bumped into this nutritional model for dietary recommendations directed towards Inuit people. It was in northern Canada, Nunavik, and so the Inuit or the subarctic people in general. It's also valid for some of the pastoralist people that live in northern Russia, for instance. Those people have also been overwhelmed by, you know, the processed food culture that comes out of the West, and they have developed cardiometabolic diseases very quickly and to higher degrees. So essentially the West came in those territories, changed the social structures, changed the way people deal with food by bringing in all those, you know, starches and sugars and oils and all sorts of very energetic, palatable, hyperpalatable foods. And then at some point, the same people that, or the same drivers that actually disrupted the system are stepping in and saying, look, you're all unhealthy, you're not eating properly, right? So it has a very paternalistic overtone of almost neocolonial overtone. You're eating unhealthy, we have to fix that. And then what happened in Nunavik, in the Nunavik space, is that they came up with a kind of food pyramid. Only the food pyramid was transformed into an igloo and with different layers. So that was to give it a kind of indigenous touch to show how much they respect their, you know, the indigenous cultures. But on the other hand, the whole igloo looked like the Mediterranean food pyramid. So the basis was made out of cereals, which actually don't exist there, and fruits and vegetables. They were depicting things like bananas and watermelons that are absolutely irrelevant in those regions. And at the very, very, so, and then you had dairy, which again, they never really seen. And then at the very top of the igloo or pyramid or whatever you want to call it, you actually found their original ancestral diet, which consists of caribou and you know, seal fish, whatever. And ironically, also in that layer, it wasn't only giving you those traditional animals and land or sea animals, but also mentioning their kind of plant-based alternative, like, you know, tofu-based seal or something. You know? So it was completely out of touch with reality. And it just shows you how much we still try to submit the entire planet to very Western-centric models. And it may well be that the Mediterranean diet does well for certain people in certain regions where it's in tune with what they're used to eat and with their genetic background and they may like it, but it's completely irrelevant in many other places of the planet. So if we're going to globalize food culture with the junk we're feeding people today and try to correct that with one single model that is somehow a construction that was made mostly in the Boston region based on, you know, in a kind of romantic view on what Mediterranean people are eating, well, then I don't think it's a good approach. And it comes in with this disrespect for diversity and variety and tradition, which I find not only not acceptable, but I find it even morally completely wrong.
Yeah, it's interesting. I once walked into a gastroenterologist's office, and as I walked in, he just said, "Yeah, I look at your red beard, and I can already tell you what foods are going to bother you." And that again shows you, like, he's seen that, you know, certain cultures or certain genetics have food has certain effects on it, and this is directly ties into it. And I'm no expert, of course, but I've seen here when I go into museums and you look at photos of Iwi or Maori, there's just very muscled people. But now there's an obesity epidemic here, I'm drawing two things together, and I have no evidence for it. But I feel like you see the historic photos and people have changed.
Oh, yeah.
And it's probably just diet related, or at least in some part diet related.
Yeah. No, it may be a complicated effect of disrupting their traditional diets together with some genetic components, because of course those ethnicities have been isolated from the rest of the world for a certain time and put on specific resources. Bodies adapt to that, so there are responses that differ from person to person and also from genetic backgrounds. So it's very striking that indeed in the in Oceania in general, so the Pacific in general, that there's a lot of problems with obesity. There's very striking percentages of obesity in some of those places.
So when did you see the anti-livestock argument come in? Is that just because of the methane argument and the way?
No, before, mostly from the from the nutritional conversations. Now, the earliest papers I have on this topic, so the earliest times that I looked into the anti-meat discourse, and also the other way around, where I try to figure out why people historically have appreciated meat. So both sides of that story. That was around 2015, 16. That's the moment when that got my interest, and very soon after that, there was in Belgium, there was a new food model that was launched. It was again a pyramid, but they have put the pyramid upside down for some reason, which I never really understood. So you have the basis of the pyramid on the top, and that's those are all the good foods. Those were only plants. And then at the very bottom, you had butter, and then under butter in the very corner of the pyramid, you hardly could see it, you had red meat. And that was colored, you know, orange. It had the back, so you should stay away from it as much as you can. There was a little smiley next to it of a little, you know, face that didn't look all too happy. And then you should eat all those plants and then restrict your red meat. But worse than that, they also expelled any processed meat from the pyramids, and they put it together in a red circle next to the pyramid of kind of excommunicated foods. And those were ultra processed foods. So they're, you know, to their credit, they took the step of isolating ultra processed foods, but they threw everything there that they didn't like, including processed meats. So you would find things like a cooked ham, which is essentially just, you know, muscle that has been salted, all right, but then it's just heated. And if you have a decent ham, nothing else happened with it. You know, it's just salted, heated muscle. And then, so that's in the same place as alcohol and crisps and candy. And it didn't belong there. Because those foods also bring in vitamins and minerals and protein. It's within the Flemish food culture, it's quite of important as well, because kids go to school and they have a bit of ham on their sandwiches or some salami or pâté or whatever. And so now they're basically telling them to take it out and to replace it with something else. The question is, what will you replace it with? So you're putting something in a circle without having very solid evidence. I mean, you can talk about moderation and it shouldn't be the staple, you know, it shouldn't be the foundation of your diet, but it's a very valuable food. I mean, it existed since the beginning of times. It's probably the earliest processed food we ever invented as humans was processed meat. By smoking it or drying it or salting it or whatever. And suddenly it becomes a vilified food together with all the junk. So I started to object to that because I didn't think it was right to do so. And then the ball got rolling, and I fell from the one astonishment into the other one. And then the environmental bit came on top of that, where again, things didn't make sense. And there's always, you know, there are always half-truths, because indeed agriculture contributes to emissions. And indeed, I mean, we should do something about it, and we should make it more sustainable. It's not in a perfect state. But the one-liners and the hyperbole and the simplification of all of that is what always bothered me. And I think a lot of these conversations are just very nuanced. They come with lots of side notes and conditions and uncertainties that you have to take with you if you want to progress. Because if you don't do that, you come to those simplified solutions that will just make things worse. It's both the human body and the ecosystem or the environment, if you wish, are very, very complex systems that will not go in the move into a benign direction if you just change, if you just press one little button to, you know, to mess up the whole response. They require very careful calibration and tinkering, not those, you know, radical kicks that you just kick in the system and then hope everything else goes well.
And of course, getting to where we were took millennia, and now they just want to flick a switch just change it. I mean, I've read some evidence, but I mean, if you ask me where that some of the processed meats are bad for you, is it a case of you get a good ham and a bad ham, or am I what is the evidence you've seen? What have you seen?
I think it has a lot to do with how you make your processed meats also. I mean, it's one denomination for a very heterogenic category to begin with. You have those deep fried chicken nuggets that are basically not only chicken, but lots of other stuff thrown inside to create bulking and stuff. And then you deep fry it. And that's obviously not going to be very healthy. But then you have things like a Parma ham that is, you know, it's a ham of a pig, and it's dried, it's salted, it has salt, okay, but salt is not necessarily a major problem as long as you know, it's incorporated in a healthy background diet, and you don't, you know, again, you don't use it as a staple food, but as something that is enriching your diet. Those are two very different products. In Parmaham, they don't even use nitrates and nitrites. You know, you could talk about those, and there's a discussion to be had about those. And it's, again, a much more nuanced discussion than we often hear. But those ones don't even contain nitrates. They're just made without. So, and they're lumping them together in one category of processed meats. Now, it's a very type, we find very different types of foods within that category.
You look at fermented meat in your studies. Yes. How do you define fermented meat? Would that ham be fermented in any way, or is it completely different? Is it like
it's a bit of a semantic discussion. Some people would say it's fermented, even though I would rather call it ripened. Or so it's the product gets transformed biochemically, and fermentation, properly speaking, I think would be when you use microorganisms like those ones that convert milk into yogurt or cheese or cabbage into fermented cabbage. Some other products are based on enzymatic transformations that are coming from the enzymes that are present naturally in the food, in the muscle. The muscle contains enzymes, and those also do their work if you give them enough time and if the conditions are appropriate, you know, temperature, humidity, and so on. So you can discuss about it. It doesn't really matter in the end. It's the conversion. It's a transformation of a agricultural substrate to make it more stable, to give it special flavors, to give it a culinary identity, and that's valid for a cheese or a ham or a yogurt or kimchi or whatever you want.
Okay, so the ham would also, like, in that broader sense, count as fermented. Yeah, okay.
It's less a microbial fermentation. It's more an enzymatic ripening than a microbial transformation. But in the end, it's the same purpose and the same intention.
In your studies, have you had to consume very strange, like, I don't know, fermented seal or something like that? Or are you not adventurous
sense? No, I haven't had any of the Inuit type of products. Now, that said, we do have our own dried fish, and I've tried, you know, kind of different types of processed fish, but I haven't tried the original authentic Inuit products. Be interesting, of course, it's quite of an acquired taste.
Yeah, and I don't know how untrained stomach would act to it, probably.
Yes, yes.
The climate argument and the messages in the media that says, you know, if you just cut meat, then this is it, we've saved the planet, you know. And then, of course, there's a lot of emotion attached to that. And I saw, I think, that Beef and Lamb talk where you spoke about, like, one steel factory in Flanders emits as much, I can't remember if it was CO2 or methane, or it emits more than all the animal agriculture why is the focus not on fossil fuels anymore, do you think, firstly? And then it's a bad journalist to ask two questions in one, but I'm going to do it because I'm scared I forget. So why is the focus not on the fossil fuels anymore? And what's your counter argument to, if we just stop eating meat, we've saved the planet? So yeah, let's start with the focus. Why is the focus not on fossil fuels anymore?
It's an excellent question. And why is it that the United Nations Environment Program has one of its website articles entitled that stating that the world's most urgent problem is meat on the United Nations Environment Program? It's crazy. I think it has to do with the fact that meat eating sounds like something we can deal with. You can always state that you're a flexitarian. You can just keep on eating meat. You're a flexitarian and you're doing your bit for the climate. But meanwhile, you still go to Thailand for holidays. So you buy the most expensive iPhone and you just keep on living as you're doing, but you're a flexitarian. So you're fixed part. I mean, you did your duty.
Yeah.
I think that plays. It's a kind of the symbolic action you take to get a better conscience as a citizen. And so it's just that. That translates also to the policy levels, because consumer citizens want that, you know, to have that narrative in place. So the rest is just not so much of a problem anymore. Also, there are most likely very powerful vested interests that benefit from having all the attention on meat and not on the other things. There's the fact that If you say that meat has to be taken out of the diets, you will have to put something else in place. So it creates lots of opportunities for food companies. That's why a lot of the big multinationals are very favorable to the anti-meat discourse. So I think it has to do with the fact that it's just very inconvenient to stop fossil fuels and, or, frankly speaking, impossible to do that in the short term. And the meat element just distracts us from that and puts all of the emphasis on a symbolic action. And that is convenient for citizens, it's convenient for the big polluters, and it's convenient for the ones that will bring new solutions to a created problem.
So it's basically optics. I mean, that's it's very sad that it's just optics, because you'd expect all these people in power to actually bring real solutions. Farmers have been demonized all over. I think in New Zealand, public's cottoned onto it a bit, and they're sick and tired of farmers being demonized. And of course, there was the protests in Europe. Do you think there's a bit of a shift where people understand that farmers aren't the kind of demons they're made out to be? I think about Clarkson's Farm. I don't know if you saw Clarkson's Farm, but they say
I've heard of it. No, I haven't seen it. Yeah.
It's very good to watch. I mean, he won awards because he's brought the challenge of farming into the public eye.
Yes.
Do you think that demonizing of farmers have shifted as the public cottoned onto it a bit, or is it still ongoing?
Things are changing. Yes, I absolutely think things are changing. And if before I said that it's convenient for citizens and it's a symbolic action, again, that is a minority of the citizens, right? It's the middle class urbanites that want to feel good and just are also detached from the rural communities and so on. It's not necessarily the case for the public at large. It has never been. But even in those circles, you feel that things are starting to change. People start to understand that if farmers just step out of the system at some point, that there will be trouble, food security. So we have had a couple of shocks to the system as well, with the pandemic, with the supply chains collapsing, with the Ukraine story. People are starting to feel that the lower foundations of the Maslow pyramid, you know, the basic needs, are starting to be compromised at some point. And then you think twice. It's very easy in a luxury, comfortable position to say, like, oh, we don't need farming, we can make everything in a lab. Well, right, until the moment gets there, and then you'll actually have to do it. And I think that is becoming more of a realization. People start to see that more specifically as a threat. And that may play a part. Then there's the fact that farmers start to speak up. Before, they were just remaining in the background. Now they start to speak up, and they come on the streets and they talk to people. We had the movement of citizen farmer movement in the Netherlands politically, which gained lots of votes. So there's a new momentum being created. Yes.
Well, I have a friend who always talks about the pendulum in politics, and if that pendulum swings too far left, also unfortunately it corrects too far right in the end. Sometimes. Yes. So the general person actually probably just wants it in the middle. I hope that kind of new government changes doesn't, you know, I look at New Zealand and they're once again implementing, allowing, well, they wanted to stop live animal exports, and now they're kind of allowing it again under special regulations. I'm not clued up on it anymore, but if you look at some of the conditions of live animal exports, I'm against it. It's that pendulum within a year has swung, you know, between the two. Are you saying that the kind of the very binary argument that plants are good and meat is bad is kind of disappearing?
It's getting less strong, I think. As a matter of fact, all the plant-based alternatives are not doing well, and that's putting it mildly. Most of those companies are just operating at loss and have never made a profit until now. They're just artificially pumping money into those products just to keep them in the retail. People don't buy them. People don't want them. And they have maybe been a gimmick, or they have been fanciful at some point in time when people try them. But now this is kind of evaporating and disappearing. So it's getting weaker. It's still there, and we will not just shake it off very easily. But it's not that strong anymore as it used to be, I think. That being said, of course, it's... The shadow of that moment is still hanging over policy and how things are being decided. And as you say, I mean, I absolutely agree that the danger with the pendulum movement is that it will swing too far, and then we will just say, oh, everything is fine with farming, and we can just leave it as it is. That's also not a good. It would also not be a good thing. I mean, things need to change.
Yeah.
And that involves also, you know, contributions to climate change and all of that. But even more than that, I would say the role that agriculture has to play in landscape management and biodiversity and keeping our waters clean and those kind of outcomes, those are extremely important. And we cannot just, you know, go from the one side of the argument to the other and say, let's just leave everything on its own.
Yeah. So Eat Lancet kind of 2.0 is due out next year. So obviously, a lot of my listeners are outdoors people and not necessarily clued up on farming. Could you in brief explain what the Eat Lancet diet is and then what your original problem with that was?
The Eat Lancet diet is a high level kind of initiative. It's coming from a young global leader of the World Economic Forum. Norwegian citizen, and she was married to a Norwegian billionaire, so she comes from that kind of circle, and she started possibly with the best intentions and initiative to fix the food system, no less. But because she was also connected to the World Economic Forum, a lot of doors opened for her, and she brought in lots of different partners, including Harvard University, specifically Walter Willett, who's the chair of nutrition, the Stockholm Resilience Center, which was part of the founders of the EAT Foundation anyway, but those people are very much connected to all sorts of United Nations initiatives like UNEP. And then the World Business Council for Sustainable Development, which is a lobby group for food multinationals. And you get this strange constellation of academics and business and policymakers. And they kind of came up with an idea to design a diet for the planet. It's literally called the planetary health diet. So if before I criticized the Mediterranean diet as one model for the planet, this is even worse. So this is a planetary health diet, and we're all supposed to eat according to that diet. Now, they claim it's flexible and respects diversity. It's really not. It has very narrow windows, and essentially livestock is only to be allowed in very small quantities. It's not a vegan diet. You could call it a semi-vegetarian diet. You can have, they advise to have, 14 grams of red meat per day, for instance. 14 grams is really nothing. So even for beef, they say 7 grams. So you can hardly, and then you can have 1.5 egg in a week and, you know, those kind of proportions.
It's extreme.
It is extreme, and it also it allows for the most extreme version as well. You can have a vegan option of that. The only advice you get is that you have to take B12 supplements. But then otherwise, it's this diet that is very unsympathetic towards any animal source foods. Even fish is only a little bit, especially if you take oily fish, which is the most healthy fish, you kind of get punished by the calories it brings in. So you can only have so much of it, like a fillet of one little sardine or something. So it's really, really limited. But nonetheless, because of the powerful actors behind it, it's very influential. People have meanwhile shown that it, one, doesn't protect against cardiometabolic disease as it claims to, because maybe something to mention here, which is important, is the diet. So the design of this diet, and that's the odd part, hasn't even been based on environmental issues. It has been based on health theory coming from Walter Willett and Harvard. So it's his view on nutrition. And then they have matched that diet to the planetary boundaries, and they said, oh, it's also good for the planet. No, but the original design is based on nutrition, which makes it even stranger. Yeah, meanwhile, people have shown, the Pure study has shown that, which is the biggest cohort globally to look at nutrition, has shown that people that stick more to the planetary health diet don't see any benefit whatsoever on protection against cardiometabolic disease. So it doesn't work to begin with. And then secondly, other people have shown that the diet is deficient in certain nutrients, which is not a surprise. That some of the more difficult nutrients that you get best or sometimes only from animal source foods are kind of limiting. And you would have to at least double the amount of animal source foods in that diet to to get adequacy. So it doesn't work. It's potentially dangerous. And nonetheless, it's the most influential diet out there that is dictating all sorts of policy decisions worldwide. The European Union, its farm-to-fork strategy, is referring, when they say healthy and sustainable diets, the reference you'll find is Willett et al. Eat Lancet diet, and that's about the only thing that they deliver. So it's like a prepackaged, handy reference that policymakers can use when they talk about healthy and sustainable diets and to justify the anti-livestock interventions.
Do you think the new version is going to be any different?
We don't know. It's also taking a long time, I have the impression. Interesting things have happened since. First of all, they have in the new commission, the new Eat Lancet commission, there's some interesting profiles that are either livestock scientists or you have Carlos Monteiro as part of them, who is the ultra-processed foods guy. He's the main voice criticizing ultra-processed foods, which is interesting because the livestock part of it, so the livestock scientist inside there will certainly have a clash with the animal rights academics that are also there. You know, there's some people there with very strong anti-livestock opinions. Then you will have the clash between the ultra-processed foods narrative and the backup this initiative gets from the World Business Council of Sustainable Development and all the, you know, the big food companies there that will certainly not appreciate any reference to ultra-processed foods in the final document. So I don't know how that will play out. There are a lot of questions that I would be interested in and see how that plays out. Another thing is that this may become a bit technical, so I try to put it easily.
Please get as technical as you want to.
Right. No, so the underpinning of the Eat Lancet diet is based on the global burden of, so except for Walter Willett's own ideas, it's also built quite a bit on the global burden of disease study, which is kind of the gold standard worldwide for policy. So the global burden of disease identifies risks. And for certain risk factors and links them to disease, but they talk about lots of sorts of different things, even, you know, effects on psychological health and whatever. But they also look at food and food related diseases, and they have traditionally an overview of the risk factors, and red meat has always been there. It has, but usually it was a tiny little bar. And certainly in the data set of the 2019 data. And the interpretation of that data, the Global Burden of Disease Consortium came out with a radical change. And the little bar of red meat inflated with a factor of almost 40. It became 40 times bigger.
What was the change? Is it just some metric that changed or something?
It's just playing with the model. So what they did is that before you had a kind of threshold where meat was considered to be safe. So you could have, 20 grams, 23 grams or something per person per day. And then suddenly they put a threshold at zero. It means that every bite of red meat you're taking is now considered to be toxic. So they just shifted that lever all the way to zero. And then, of course, the response becomes much bigger. Then they changed also, they claimed that they have done new systematic reviews and meat analysis, but neither have they given an explanation for the reason of changing that threshold, nor have they shown the new systematic reviews. So we absolutely didn't agree with this with some other folks. And so we wrote a letter to The Lancet in a response, which was led by Alice Stanton from Ireland. And so we addressed we mentioned all our concerns, and it's a long story. And it took ages to get that letter published, and we had to go through many difficulties to be able to put that letter out. But then we succeeded. And we got a response also from the Global Burden of Disease. Not a really satisfactory response, but they were even admitting that there were indeed valid points and mistakes being made. But it's still out there, and it's still used to construct policy and it's a stepping stone for other studies, and studies continuously refer to the global burden of disease. So it's still creating damage, even though the authors have admitted that there's an issue with it. Then the interesting part is they came out with another study that specifically looked at red meat.
Yeah.
And they now said something very different. They said that there's so much uncertainty in the data that until about 200 grams per day, you cannot say much with confidence. And you can only have very weak. So they actually say what we were saying. But the GBD study is still out there and still doing its job. Now, why am I mentioning this? Because GBD is used for Eat Lancet, and the whole controversy around, you know, that discussion, how will that translate into the new Eat Lancet recommendations? Yeah. So that's another factor we cannot predict. We'll have to wait for the outcome.
It's interesting because I wrote an article for a newspaper I worked for about kind of how some of the Eat Lancet stuff was debunked. But then, you know, a week later, another journalist just writes an article about the Eat Lancet diet, says you have to do A, B, C, and D, and then you just want to give up. Yeah. You know, it doesn't matter that you say this has been debunked, or then it's just, it just goes, they just
well,
keep
it does
on
actually.
Using
I mean, I think that some things have had their impact. The fact that we corrected this GBD story there has been an impact.
Yeah,
we started the dialogue with the authors. Actually, there's been a big controversy between Willett, leading Eat Lancet, and Chris Murray, which is leading the Global Burden of Disease. At some point in time, Willett reacted to the new study on red meat, you know, that stated the uncertainty and the fact that we have to be careful if we say anything about red meat, by saying, "Oh, this is a bad study." And then Murray responded to Willett. So, you know, remember, they were partnering in the Eat Lancet framework.
Yeah.
Responded something like, "No, this is how science works. I know it may be inconvenient to have to change your beliefs," and he literally calls it beliefs in his answer to Willett. But it's just how science progresses, and so that has, I think, that even though our part may have been a small part, but it does change the conversation. It just it opens up conversations, and that's the most important bit. The fact that the Eat Lancet diet correction for nutrient adequacy has been proposed. It's the fact that, you know, you have to, the diet is deficient in nutrients, has been very impactful as well. So those things change the conversation. It does happen. It's just that media doesn't capture all that goes there.
Yeah, because, yeah, they've got a specific message.
They don't understand it. And then secondly, they're not even interested in the right messages, in the correct messages.
So two last questions. One, is there anything that you are positive about? I mean, you just mentioned this. Is there anything that you, or you feel, I don't know, is it the pressure too much? Like, is there anything that you're positive about?
Well, maybe what I can mention still is that I was one of the co-founders of the so-called Dublin Declaration on the Societal Role of Livestock. And so that's an initiative where we're trying to start that conversation and to have a more balanced dialogue and honest conversation around livestock. And by now, this declaration has been signed by 1,200 scientists worldwide. So that's kind of impactful. I mean, that's something that makes a difference. We've been attacked, of course. We've been attacked by The Guardian, by Greenpeace, and so on. So they're trying to depict us as industry scientists, even though there was no funding or instruction whatsoever coming from any of the livestock industries. But, you know, that's how they frame it. They take a couple of things out of context. They asked for our emails to a freedom of information request. So they went through our emails, took out the bits that are, you know, convenient to put into a narrative, and they tried to depict it as an industry initiative, which is absolutely not. But anyway, the point is that this declaration has had its impact. It gives also it gives confidence to scientists as well, because many people have been bullied and been afraid to speak up. But the fact that, you know, that there are 1,000 scientists out there that are actually willing to come out together is something that creates hope and confidence. And I hope that it's catalyzing, you know, a pathway towards more balanced discussions in the future.
Yeah, because that was one of my questions, like, how do you counter this accusation? Well, you're funded by big meat, and then I mean, you've answered that.
So it's even so ridiculous that I'm in contrast to all the people from the other side who's just selling books and getting speaker fees, I refuse every speaker fee I'm invited to. I don't receive money from livestock industries to begin with. And my projects are funded by European money or national money or research grant. So I have no funding. I refuse all my speaker fees. And yet I'm accused of being an industry shill. But yeah, it doesn't really matter in the end. I mean, if it wouldn't be attacked, it would mean that we have no impact. Yeah, so I kind of see it as an encouragement.
Then a last question, because my podcast has a lot to do with the outdoors and things. Do you do anything to procure your own meat, like hunting or fishing or have chickens at home or something like that?
Yeah, unfortunately not. No, living in Brussels, that is the kind and the work schedule I have. Now, when I was a kid at home, we were raising chickens and rabbits and growing our own vegetables. And so I come from a background where we were kind of at least filling in parts of our diets with home produced foods. Yeah. So I've been through all that and I've seen how it goes. And as a kid, I participated a bit in the process. But nowadays, no, I just depend on what is available in the shops, as most people.
Yes. So if you're ever in New Zealand and you want to fly fish or you want to go hunt, I volunteer to take you out if you have time. So yeah. Please.
I absolutely love New Zealand, so I'd be happy to come over here.
It's an open offer if you ever want to take it up. Frederik, thank you so much. That was very insightful, and good luck in your work, and I'm really glad it's had an impact.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.